We have as our teacher this morning, Jesse Peledonski. He is known to us as an artist, a musician, plays around the city. He's also board certified chaplain and works in the cancer section of Children's Hospital, which I did not know. Jesse, we're pleased to have you this morning.
Well, it's really wonderful to be with you this morning. I'm so grateful for the Eighth Day Faith community, and it's so such richness that you all bring together here. And I've been reading a bunch of the teachings that people have been bringing over the last 3 or 4 months, and it's been wonderful to taste of that, of the Ann Barnett's word on hope, and Mike Brown's on peace, and Fred's sermon from last fall, and David's, and Mead's, and Cito's, and those are some of the ones that I have sampled, but I just so much appreciate the thoughtfulness and the richness of the theological and the spiritual conversation that you all bring. I was here for Marcia's Advent teaching on joy, and I was totally intrigued by her evocation of resistance joy, and I was especially struck by the point she made about singing in the midst of suffering to transform suffering into joy. And I have a lifelong interest in that topic. I have used music in all sorts of places that have a lot of pain and darkness and despair. And I have been really amazed and humbled by the power of music in those settings. Bernice Johnson Regan of the women's a cappella group Sweet Honey in the Rock joined the civil rights movement as a 19-year-old and helped to form something called the Freedom Singers. And she said we would meet for hours before we would go out and meet, you know, the attack dogs or the fire hoses or whatever the violence was. And if we met for 3 hours, we would sing for 2.5 of those hours. And it was the singing that gave us the courage to face the attack dogs and the fire hoses. And Archbishop Desmond Tutu said that without the incredibly powerful music of South Africa, racial apartheid would never have fallen. The African American tradition definitely has many examples of the vibrancy of spirituals from the time of slavery and the more contemporary black gospel music of making spirit available in the midst of the deepest human suffering and helping people to make a way where there is no way. I know when I worked at Children's Hospital on the oncology unit for 7 years with children with cancer and their families, I was a spiritual counselor, but I carried my guitar around every day, and a lot of people thought I was the musician in residence. They didn't really totally get what I was about, but I was working with kids with cancer and their families and working on the bone marrow transplant unit, and actually I met Connie there for the first time when she was doing her social work internship in 1992. Music was incredibly powerful, and one of the things that I was just blown away by and would never have guessed is how much joy there could be in a place with children with cancer in their families. And 2-year-old Mohammed, who is, his family was from Liberia, would see me coming hundreds of yards away, and he would yell, "Jesse! Jesse, sing E-I-O! Sing E-I-O!" That old children's spiritual, EIO. And I came to believe, and really fervently believe, that all music can be spiritual if it's touching people in their heart and freeing them. And music was central for me in the whole experience of accompanying little children. And the ones I got the closest to were often the ones who were the sickest, because they were in the hospital and in and out a lot. And early on, I came to the conclusion I can't control who lives and who dies, but if somehow I'm able to be used by the Spirit to bring a little bit of healing or joy into that environment, then that's a blessing for all of us. And it really was a blessing for me in amazing ways. And I had some powerful and goosebump kind of experiences of just being with folks. And I remember little 8-year-old Jason, who family was quite evangelical, but they really welcomed my music, and he loved dinosaurs, so Puff the Magic Dragon was a favorite of his. And but when his bone marrow transplant did not work, I remember being there in the intensive care unit when The life support system was being removed, and singing Puff the Magic Dragon and also other spirituals that the family related to. And the image came to me that this is musical, spiritual midwifery into dying. And there are others who have used that concept since then, but it really struck me deeply that I was a midwife in that setting and that the music was crucial to it. And of course, it was also incredibly sad, and I cried too, so that's part of the story. I want to share three songs with you during this teaching time, and the first one happens to be an alternate setting of the Lord's Prayer that was highly influenced by the indigenous Maori people of New Zealand. I noticed that you all have one of the context, one of the settings of the Lord's Prayer from the New Zealand Book of Prayer. And this is a slightly different one that uses more, it starts out eternal spirit, earth maker, pain bearer, life giver, source of all that is and shall be, mother and father of us all. It's a bit different than what you have. It has some similarities. But anyways, this is a musical setting of that. Reasons I think that God called me to work with kids with cancer is that I come from a family that does not grieve and has a lot of things to grieve. And my heart was really frozen in a lot of ways. I had a good way of putting my persona out there, but really my heart was pretty frozen. And it's hard to work at a place like an oncology unit with kids and keep your heart frozen. And it was a great gift to me to be there on 4YELLOW and get attached to kids. And some of them got better and some of them didn't and died. And my heart was cracked open, and that was a good thing. And one of the things that Children's Hospital really taught me was that it was impossible to have true joy without grief. And I really realized I'd been sort of skating in this very narrow area emotionally, and that feeling grief gave me the opportunity to really feel joy for the first time. One of the most important things I've learned over the years, for the most of my time as a spiritual counselor, I worked with adults, I worked in hospitals, and I worked with hospice, in home hospice for 10 years or so in Montgomery County, Prince George's County. And one of the most important things I learned is just being with people when they're in that wilderness place, just being willing not to try to fix it, because there's nothing to fix, not to try to make it better. And people are starving with the need to have someone willing to just sit with them and not be afraid of what has happened, not be afraid of their fear or of their anger or of their hopelessness or of their rage or whatever it might be, depression. And there's obviously, without saying, a lot of loss when one is facing the end of life, the impending loss of loved ones, parent, spouse, grandparent, loss of physical capabilities. And I found with many men in particular, and it's also with women as well, but the question of who am I now if I'm sick and I'm no longer the attorney that I was, or the physician, or the world-class physicist, or the artist, who am I? And having everything stripped away from you. And I found that helping folks or encouraging them to lament, to give voice to their pain, and if they were from the Judeo-Christian tradition, acquainting them with the lament psalms, like Psalm 13 that was read right at the beginning. How long, Lord, how long must I be in pain and sorrow all my days? I cry to you in the day, where are you? I cry to you in the night, I don't hear you. One gentleman I accompanied was from Korea. He worked for the CIA. He was one of their top experts on North Korea. And he was definitely experiencing this crisis. Who am I if I'm no longer the CIA's expert on North Korea? And he was part of his Korean evangelical church, but he shared with me, you know, I haven't told my pastor this, but if I lived in North Korea, and if I lived in Oregon, rather, I would take the physician-assisted suicide route because I'm ready to check out of here. And Cicely Saunders, who was a physician and the founder of the modern hospice movement in the 1960s, said that often what precipitates the desire for physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia is spiritual pain that's undiagnosed and untreated. I had a number of experiences as a hospice chaplain that fit that bill. When I began to read the lament psalms to him, like, how long, O Lord, or my God, why have you forsaken me? He leapt up and he said, give me that book. Where is that? I have to show my pastor that that's in the Bible. So many people at the end of life feel emotionally elated in their pain. And many of them are doing spirituality 101 at the end of life. These lament psalms provided Lee a way in, a way to feel connected to God and his community that did not sugarcoat or cover up the profound disorientation, the grief, the anger, the rage that he was experiencing. I'm going to play a musical setting that I composed for Psalm 13 that I sang for Lee. How long can this pain go on, Lord? This grief I can hardly bear. How long will anguish grip me? Agony wring my mind. Light up my eyes with your presence. Let me feel your love in my bones. Keep me from losing myself, Lord, in ignorance and despair. Teach me patience, Lord. Let me trust that your love enfolds me. My heart feels desolate and dry. How long will this pain go on, Lord? This grief I can hardly bear. How long will anguish grip me? Agony wring my mind. Light up my eyes with your presence. I will sing to the Lord at all times, even from the depths of my pain. La 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 la. I'm a big fan of Walter Brueggemann, and I've heard him evoked here. And one of the things that he talks about is that 30 to 40% of the Psalms are lament Psalms, but we never hear them in church. They're excised from the Revised Common Lectionary, except in Holy Week. But if they're not available to us in our prayer time as a community and in our daily prayer time, we're greatly impoverished, and when we really are in need, they're not there for us because they're not inside of us. How will we be able to pray and to be able to question? Brueggemann says that the historical Jewish way of speaking faith understands that reality is a dialogue, and in that dialogue, Israel groans and cries out and threatens and rages and exults. And that's not only an act of sin sometimes, because sometimes it is, but it's also an act of legitimate fidelity and faith. And when I was at Earlham School of Religion, the Quaker Seminary in Indiana, many years ago, I took a class on Judaism where we read the Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel's book on the Hasidic masters of the 1800s in Europe. The book is called Souls on Fire. And he told the story of Rabbi Levi Yitzhak of Berdichev in Lithuania, one of the great rabbis, and how on the holiest day of the year, Yom Kippur, Levi Yitzhak got up in the temple and raised his fist and said, God, we have atoned for our sins. When will you atone for yours? This was in a time of great pogroms and persecution, horrible things happening to the community there. And Elie Wiesel says, in Jewish culture, that is kosher. If you're speaking the truth to God, The people we love the most, we tell the truth to. But Brueggemann says that the classic practice of the Christian church is to turn our pain into guilt in deference to a perfect God. If something's wrong, it must be our fault. And sometimes it is our fault, and we have to confess that. But he says that the Christian church in general, Catholics, liberal Protestants, evangelicals, we're a lot better about singing songs of praise than we are about complaints and laments. But if one only praises, not having any serious interaction with God when things are tough, too often what happens in the sanctuary is nice and tidy, while a lot of the really important nitty-gritty spiritual work happens in the 12-step meetings in the basement or the pastoral counseling offices on the second floor. And Brueggemann's also very clear that there's a political, social side to lament, and his book, The Prophetic Imagination, talks a lot about that. But it's not just about our individual salvation. It's about the community daring to speak up to God and to grapple. In fact, the famous story of Jacob wrestling with the angel until he gets a blessing. What is the blessing Jacob gets? A new name. And what is the new name? He who struggles with God. And the name is Israel. And that is the name of the people. The people Israel are they who struggle with God. I find that profound. I found that very profound. And Brueggemann goes on to say, in these most treacherous times that we live in, the church desperately needs to reclaim the lament tradition in order to be faithful to our call. Well, I'm going to change gears here a little bit and close out with a song. I was thinking of Fred Taylor as I was preparing for today, and Fred was part of the Seekers community when I joined many years ago. And 10 years ago, he preached a sermon on the parable of the prodigal son, and I happened to be guest musician here at Eighth Day and sang a song out of the African-American tradition. And I was noticing in his sermon, his last sermon that he gave here in September, he was reprising some of that on the prodigal son. And in a very real sense, this parable, I think, is Jesus' response to our lectionary reading of today, where he is called God's beloved son, in whom God is well pleased. I think the parable of the prodigal son, when Jesus tells that story, he's saying, this is not just about me. This is about you. You are God's beloved daughter. You are God's beloved son. This is the nature of God. When I left my native land, I was well supplied. I went astray, I done wrong. Now I'm dissatisfied. I believe I'll go back home. Believe I'll go back home. Man. I believe I'll go back home. Acknowledge I done wrong. Go back to my native land. Place I love so dear. There they have good food to eat. I am starving here. Go back to my father's house. Kneel and hide my face. Say I am not worthy. I'll seek a servant's place. I believe I'll go back home. Believe I'll go back home, man. I believe I'll go back home. Acknowledge I done wrong. Father too, Father saw him coming. Met him with a smile. Threw his arms round him. Now here's my wandering child. Father to his servant said, go kill the fatted calf. Call my friends far and near. My son come home at last. I believe I'll go back home. believe I'll go back home, man. I believe I'll go back home, acknowledge I done wrong. Friends that came, danced and sang. All sorrow now was past. The father's face lit with joy. That son come home at last. But the other son was jealous. I thought I heard him say, you gave my brother the fatted calf, but I never went astray. I believe I'll go back home. Believe I'll go back home now. I believe I'll go back home. Acknowledge I done wrong. Father said to his eldest son, you've been good and kind. I never gave you the fatted calf, but all I have is thine. I believe I'll go back home. Believe I'll go back home, man. I believe I'll go back home. Acknowledge I done wrong. Amen.